Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I am your host for the first hour. Happy to report that I am kicking off this show with Peter Buchvar. He is the Chief Investment Officer at the Bleakley Advisory Group. Peter is one of my favorite guests to have on, and also one of my favorites to follow on his website at The Book Report, which I will post a link to, where Peter breaks down all the recent data and what really is important for markets, and also provide some of his comments on the back of that. Peter, let's start off with kind of a high-level look at not just what's going on in the U.S., but what's going on around the world, where it seems like central banks and markets, even for that reason, are getting us into an environment where we are going to continue to see lower interest rates and even negative interest rates. We had the new ECB head, Christine Lagarde, be announced, as well as some Fed nominees from Trump that also, it seems like, read very much off of Trump's playbook as he continues to push on the Fed to lower rates. What are your general comments about the environment that the world is in, and especially for investors, where it's hard to not expect and assume that we're going to see lower interest rates around the world, and even further into negative yielding interest rates around, well, Europe and some other countries?
Well, the number one issue is we have slowing growth. The response in interest rates is to that. So markets are only focused on the response and that, okay, central banks are going to ease, and they're not paying attention to, well, why are we in this position? We're in this position because growth is slowing dramatically. The World Bank has an estimate for GDP growth in 2019 of only 2.6%. U.S. growth, when you have combined the likely second quarter number of probably 1.5 with the first quarter around 3, you're going to get 2.25 type percent growth. And in the jobs data is now softening in that we're seeing less hiring. Manufacturing globally is in a recession if you look at the global PMI, and that's spilling over into services. So this collapse in interest rates, again, is in response to the softening data. And at least with the U.S., the key will be earnings that we'll start to get in 2 to 3 weeks, where companies are going to quantify the impact of the slowing and what it means for earnings estimates.
So data has been weak in, let's say, Europe and weakening in China, but just recently it seems to be trending much more aggressively down in the U.S. as well. Do you think this is simply the U.S. not being able to weather the storm of what's going on around the world as much as they had for some of the prior years? Or is this just the bigger picture that the world is kind of screwed, to put it in a simple sense?
Well, no one is immune to the slowing that is going on in China, irrespective of the tariffs. But you certainly throw all the tariffs out there, and it's turned upside down global supply chains and has really negatively impacted confidence. So you get a slowdown in China, then you get a slowdown in the rest of Asia. You get a slowdown in Asia, you get a slowdown in Europe. You get a slowdown in Europe and Asia, and then you start to get a slowdown in the U.S. And we're all in this boat together. I'm not as confident as the markets in thinking that somehow further central bank easing is somehow going to help us in this situation. The cost of capital is already very low, and I consider negative interest rates more of a poison than an anecdote, particularly when it comes to banks. And if you continue to damage the profitability of your banks, it's tough to be confident that you're going to get faster economic growth.
Now, how does this relate to the financial markets and for investors? We're seeing an interesting environment where stocks are going up, bonds are going up, and even gold is going up. It does seem like the world does have, or the financial system has, too much money, and they just don't know where to put it. But if money is continuing to get cheaper, is there, when can we expect this scenario to change? It seems like it could keep on going for a while longer.
Well, it depends. I mean, you look at the Japanese experience. They have 30 years of easing, and the Nikkei is down 50% from where it was 30 years ago. their stock market doesn't even respond to the Bank of Japan buying ETFs. They own 70% of the ETF market. You know, what you're seeing here is just this typical Pavlovian dog response to Fed easing and the drop in interest rates overseas, and say, okay, rates are low, central banks are easing, you got to buy stocks, irrespective of the underlying fundamentals. I mean, it's just really just a bizarre time from period when you can do all the analysis of fundamentals that you want, and it really doesn't matter when the overwhelming influence on markets are central banks. And even you take the China-U.S. Discussions last weekend when Trump and Xi met, I don't really see them being any closer to a deal unless both sides compromise, and that doesn't necessarily seem to be what's going to happen. In the meantime, we're left with tariffs on 25% on half the goods we import from China, and we got to pay tariffs on about over $100 billion worth of stuff we export to them. So this is a major drag on economic growth. And but again, stocks are just focused on rates and central banks and assuming that they can save the world. And I don't think that that's necessarily a prudent bet.
Yeah, well, it's a good comparison to see what's gone on in Japan, too, because they've been playing this game for longer and more consistently than a lot of these central banks, but definitely seems with Christine Lagarde at the head of the ECB. I know it's hard to get more dovish than Draghi, but it really doesn't seem like she's going to change anything over there, does it?
No, she will just continue on with what they're doing and somehow expecting a different result. But unless there's fiscal stimulus of some sort in Europe, there's no chance that more monetary easing is going to do anything. And, you know, now they're in a situation where just imagine if they do have success in generating faster economic growth, and, you know, you're going to see a sharp rise in interest rates. So what are they going to do then? So this is a very dangerous circle that we're in, that if central banks become successful one day in generating higher inflation or even growth accelerates, you can be damn sure that interest rates are going to be much higher, and you're going to have a pretty ugly situation in global bond markets. So it really is this very bizarre situation globally that seems to be getting more bizarre.
Yeah, we're going down that road. But what about currencies, too? Trump keeps on making comments about all these other countries manipulating their currencies, wants the Fed to lower interest rates for a number of reasons, but does also push on lowering interest rates to hopefully lowering the U.S. dollar. In terms of currency wars, do you see anything changing in a drastic sense?
Well, the Trump's viewpoint of fighting this currency war is trying to convince the Fed to lower interest rates. So by trying to get his people, so to speak, on the Fed that are interested in cutting rates, that's his way of fighting back. But this, you know, beggar thy neighbor type situation that we are in, if that's just going to accelerate, there aren't going to be any winners. So you have tariffs that are throwing mud in the spokes of economic activity, and you're going to have currency battles now and everyone trying to fight each other on that end, and this poison of negative interest rates. It's just truly bizarre world. But I don't see this as being good for economic growth and economic confidence, no matter what the stock market thinks.
But this is all in the face, too, of the longest economic expansion on record, too, right? So it does seem like other central banks, the Fed, have lost a lot of their ammo, or their ammo doesn't carry the same firepower. And eventually, it seems like we will get that recession. But is there an environment, too, where you could see a recession happen and somehow the markets stay somewhat levitated?
I mean, with what central bankers are trying to do here, I guess anything is possible. I don't think that'll end up being the case. I mean, I just don't believe in free lunches, and you know, the market believes that there's a free lunch here, but I don't believe in one. So at least for now, there is one. But I think if you go into a global recession and earnings start to really fall, no amount of central bank easing is going to help. Just again, look at Japan. You know, if you bought the Nikkei every time the Japanese embarked on more easing, how'd that do for you?
Not well, exactly. But you know what? Other central banks just keep on trying to play off that or read off that playbook. What about the action that we've seen in the metals? More particular, gold. Gold finally broke out of this 5 to 6 year trading range it was in, and we've seen a lot more volatility, double digit dollar wise moves every day. That brings more investors in, more traders into the sector, and a breakout definitely helps with a little momentum to the upside, finally. But we're not seeing silver follow along. And in terms of the other metals, especially industrial metals, they're stuck because of this global slowing growth. But that gold breakout, are you encouraged of the moves that we're seeing in gold and the maybe investment opportunity?
I do think that this move is for real because of the exploding size of the pile of negative yielding securities. And you can overlay a chart of gold to that pile of negative yielding securities. And it's pretty highly correlated. And then you can throw in, of course, the Fed easing, dollar weakness, softness in the U.S. and global growth. And I mean, this is the ideal setup for precious metals. And I think that's why gold has gotten its legs here. And I think this is only the beginning. Silver certainly lagged because of the industrial side, but I'd be hard pressed to think that silver is going to continue to languish here. Gold's rally continues here as the ratio between the two widen out to and historically very high spreads.
Yeah, we've talked about that gold-silver ratio and how it continues to go. I think it's in the 90s now, which we have not seen. I think we've only seen that one other time throughout the recent financial history. When it comes to, though, the inflation narrative, inflation is one of those fundamental drivers for gold that goes kind of hand-in-hand with low interest rates as two drivers. So we're still kind of missing that inflation fundamental driver, though, aren't we?
Well, consumer price inflation, yes, but asset inflation and certainly in bonds is just got another adrenaline push higher. So, yes, but I think that gold's has had a specious relationship to CPI because we know the shenanigans that go on there. But I think they clearly see what central banks are doing here to their currencies and their bond markets and to rates. And you had to reverse and say, how can you not own gold?
Yeah, well, you compare how undervalued it is from other financial assets. That's more about a rotation, though, of money, right? I think we've already started to see some of that rotation, but so much money was created, so much money landed on risk-off assets and into bonds that we're seeing that rotation back into some of these risk-off while also still supporting the underlying risk-on attitude. As we are now in the second quarter, though, here, Peter, what are the key factors you're going to be watching for managing money, for looking ahead at what is truly going to drive markets? I know it's still headline driven and still dominated by the Fed, but what are the crucial points that you could share with us?
I think it'll be really important, as I said earlier, what earnings are going to be like. You know, if this slowdown continues and earnings growth continues to slip, earnings estimates continue to fall, well, the market's just getting more and more expensive. And that's a bubble type situation where stocks go up, earnings go down, and valuations get inflated. And that's never a lasting thing. And I think that's the biggest concern here is just chasing things in the face of deteriorating fundamentals historically doesn't end that well.
Yeah, very true. Well, Peter, it's great having you on the show, and you are pointing out, you know what, some concerning signs for these markets, and I know a lot of the bears are saying, we've been saying this forever, and fair enough, they have been saying it for years, but maybe sooner rather than later, it will actually start to matter. We have seen some cracks in the overall financial markets, but there is still seeming to be a lot of liquidity out there and money that is flowing into now some of the safer assets, but still kind of surprising to see U.S. markets up so high. Peter, great having you on the show. Again, go check out Peter's website, The Book Report. I will post a link to that. He is also the Chief Investment Officer over at the Bleakley Advisory Group. Thanks for your time this weekend, Peter.
Thanks so much, Corey.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. I hope everybody enjoyed that first segment with Peter Buchvar. In this segment, I am joined by Chris Temple, founder and editor of The National Investor. And for all of you who do not know, Chris joins me on pretty much a daily basis on our website to break down some of the key aspects that are moving markets and focus on those markets that do need to be watched by investors. Chris, there's a lot for us to talk about recapping this week, and we're going to start off with the jobs number that came out on Friday. It really beat estimates. The jobs data came in at about 224,000 jobs, where the estimate was around 160. This finally comes in, I guess, the face of consecutive weaker data that we have seen in the U.S. What was your thought on this surprise beat finally for U.S. economic data?
Well, it was a surprise beat, Corey, but I think if you look at the broader context, the fact still is that relative to the rest of the world, certainly the rest of the developed world, the U.S. economic statistics have been better. They've been better for quite a while. And yes, the couple of employment reports before this were subpar. This helps to make up for it. If you look at the running average of monthly job gains, it's still fairly robust. Befitting an economy that is maturing and with full employment. So, you know, I don't think that there's a major story in this. I think the markets early on made it a major story because everybody had gotten onto the same side of the proverbial boat in a number of areas, whether it's the dollar, whether it's gold, whether it's treasuries that have been obscenely overbought. I think the yields are going to go much lower and bond prices much higher. But in the near term, like those other things, everybody gotten ahead of themselves, figuring that the Fed by the end of this month is going to be lowering interest rates, maybe starting out with a 50 basis point cut, which is what, you know, 25% chance you had before Friday morning of that priced into the Fed funds futures market. So, you know, the overreaction in the market early on was simply because everybody had just gotten out too far over their skis. It doesn't change the big picture, though, one iota.
Yeah, that's very true. But it does, I think, give some of those people that just got way too far ahead of themselves a little step back. And you need to realize that the markets did just get so extended, especially in terms of expecting what the Fed would do. Let's talk about those market reactions, though. Some of the interesting ones were gold moving down, which that actually does make sense in the face of good economic data. However, there was a gradual buy that came into the gold market, with gold closing just a tad over 1400. We saw the U.S. dollar have a good day, up about 48 basis points, right around, well, it's over 97 now. And the U.S. markets, they opened up down, but then they garnered a buy throughout the day and closed very much close to neutral. What caught your eye most about the initial reaction and then the follow through throughout Friday?
Well, again, the initial reaction all across the board was because people had been positioned far too aggressively for a Fed that's going to not ease quite as fast as a lot of people think. They're going to do it. There's no question about that. But it made everybody take a step back. And I think toward the end of the day, especially where the stock market was concerned, people realized, okay, you know, this one strong employment number that we had certainly doesn't mean the Fed's going to raise interest rates. Maybe it means that they wait longer. We'll see what happens. You know, notably, when you look overseas, I mean, the German Bund had broken a negative 40 basis points on their 10-year yield. That sold off a little bit during the day, too. So everywhere you look, everything that had really gotten stretched recently came back a little bit, but the overall trends of everything, in my opinion, have not changed by and large, certainly not for what I call the odd couple, bonds and gold. The dollar, there's still a risk of it moving higher than a lot of people want to see and that the markets can handle. And likewise with the stock market, even though we had nominal new highs this week, earnings season is coming up and it's not going to be that pleasant.
Yeah, that earnings season is going to be closely watched. But one other trend that actually timed with news regarding the ECB leader, which will be Christine Lagarde, really talks about these low to negative interest rates that are dominating Europe, and the Trump still pushing on the Fed to lower their rates. That is really the overall theme here, even if maybe the Fed pushes back a July rate cut. Fact of the matter is, we should be continuing to expect lower rates around the world, and even negative rates, correct?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question at all the direction that things are going. And as you and I discussed earlier in the week, when it came out that it's somewhat of a surprise move, the Poobah's meeting in Brussels tapped Christine Lagarde, who is currently the head of the International Monetary Fund, to be the new head of the European Central Bank. In retrospect, the perfect person for the job. She's number one, very political, rather than apolitical, which is what central bankers are supposed to be. And number two, she's very much in favor of negative interest rates. So we're just going to get more of what we have had. And even if the Fed were not under pressure and not predisposed to grudgingly follow along, the fact that you've got these negative interest rate regimens increasing around the world inevitably pulls the Fed in that very same direction. When market interest rates, and you know, we broke again below the 2% level on a 10-year note here this week, Corey, before it closed a bit above it with Friday's sell-off, but nevertheless, that's well below the federal funds rate. And for as long as we stay down here, let alone go lower, the Fed, even if you have strong economic numbers, has no choice but to follow the market, or they cause more problems, even if they don't.
Yeah, that is true, and unfortunately, they are not immune to what's going on around the world. Do you think, though, in this environment, on top of that odd couple trade where treasuries go up, even the precious metals go up, that it could still also mean that U.S. markets, or at least one market that is looked at as the best markets out there, they also go up, too, just because there is so much money, and money is just looking for anywhere to get some sort of yield or gain?
Well, you definitely have that to some extent, where you have that so-called TINA phenomenon, TINA being the acronym for there is no alternative. And that certainly, all else being equal, keeps a floor somewhat under stocks compared to what you'd have if you didn't have accommodative central banks. But people will have to be careful, Corey, not to get too smug with the idea that all of a sudden traders can be bulletproof again and just throw money at the stock market indiscriminately, and the Fed's got your back. Don't ever forget, and I brought this up from time to time, I know Peter, who you just had on, mentions this regularly himself, that there's a reason why these central banks are so easy with money. It's because things are not good on Main Street. Corporate earnings are deteriorating. We're going to see a negative quarter here in the U.S. when the second quarter numbers come out. And if things don't straighten out real fast with this trade conflict with China, and I still don't believe in the grand scheme of things there's going to be much change, then you've got companies that are going to look ahead to the balance of the year and maybe farther and still be subdued. So there's only so much increase in stock valuations that negative interest rates or lowering interest rates here in the U.S. are going to get you.
Yeah, that is true. But even if we are in this environment where we do continue to see lower interest rates, do you find that there is a big opportunity there then to take more positions in treasuries, just assuming that, you know what, the Fed isn't going to be able to ignore what's going on around the world, the rest of the world, or a lot of it is in negative interest rates? I know they're already so low, but why not just kind of close your eyes and put money into treasuries and ride them as they continue to move?
Well, as opposed to the stock market, yes. I mean, that's kind of, in relative terms, a no-brainer. Despite the people still trying to tell you that other countries are going to dump treasuries and so forth, we are going to inevitably here in the U.S. join the rest of the world back near zero. And in my current issue I'm working on, I refer back to a conversation with Kyle Bass a while ago, and he says that perhaps by the time Trump is running for re-election, we're already going to be down darn near zero here again in the U.S. once again. And it's not going to be anything dramatic because we'll only be playing catch up with the rest of the world. So when you have a strong dollar, when you have long-term paper with a positive yield here, where half of the paper and the rest of the world has negative yields, it doesn't take a genius to figure out what you're going to do with at least some of your money. And 2% yield on a 10-year treasury doesn't sound great, but if in the next year and a half, let's say, to follow Kyle Bass's example, if we went even to the all-time low for treasuries, which was a yield of, I think, 1.36 or 3-something percent, you're going to have about another 8 or 10% capital appreciation on those treasuries that you buy today. That's not bad when everything else looks so tenuous.
Yeah, it all comes down to that risk reward too, and it really just doesn't seem like there is much of a risk of rates all of a sudden going much higher. Do you think that lower interest rates though can help support the economy? Not that it's going to be booming, but in this slow growth environment, rather than having a full-fledged recession where everybody kind of gets hurt?
That's the best, in my opinion, Corey, that you can hope for. Instead of having a real deep recession and a lot of bankruptcies and so forth, what the central banks are doing is drawing this out and turning what would otherwise be a quick, sharp pain into that slow, dull ache that I've talked about. But it's one that's going to be around for years. A lot of people have heard me and others use the word Japanification when it comes to the rest of the world. It is now underway in Europe and will be next, inevitably, where you have interest rates at zero and you still don't have economic growth to speak of. You still don't have corporate profits to speak of. And you have the slow motion nationalization of at least some debt and some trouble on a part of these central banks just to keep everything from imploding. You're not going to get growth out of this. The only thing you can hope to get is a slower bleed and the slower, duller ache that we're going to have. You're not going to get major economic growth out of all this money printing. They've already proven that we're not going to get it.
Yeah, so very true. Well, Chris, good chatting with you. Thanks for taking some time on this weekend show to share and recap the importance of what we saw this week and to, I think, give everybody a little step back and a little pause from just how extreme these markets had gotten in terms of what they were expecting out of the Fed. And I think just assuming that data was going to just continue to weaken without any sort of positives coming in. Chris, good chatting with you. Thanks, as always. Have a great rest of your weekend.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am chatting with John Kaiser in this segment. John is the founder of Kaiser Research Online. And John, you focus a lot on junior stocks, but in a broad sense, also the resource markets. Let's start off with a broad comment on the resource markets, especially when it comes to the junior stocks, is that there still doesn't seem to be this audience rushing into the gold sector, even after this breakout. Now, this is a technical breakout, and I know some of the larger stocks have been doing better, something that we talked about even at the early part of last month, but in a broad sense, still, again, I think investors are very distracted by other markets. What do you think, though? This technical breakout doesn't seem, at least right now, to be enough to drive people into the markets. What's it going to take?
You know, it's really frustrating. We see gold go over 1,400, challenge 1,450. It's the highest it's been since 2013. It sort of falls back below 1,400 when it looks like the trade war between China and the United States is going to be put on pause. And it's crept back above 1,400 in the last couple days. But there is very little, if any, a follow-through in the resource junior sectors, including optionality plays. For example, Midas Gold, they had to do a $20 million financing at 60 cents to keep everything, the permitting cycle in Idaho for the Stibnite mine going. But it's like limping along at 62, 64 cents, even though gold at over $1,400 with the reduction in the federal tax corporate tax rate last year, it should be starting to to track, develop an uptrend. And at $1,600, which seems like merely a couple hundred bucks away, that stock should be doing really well. So I think the audiences that traditionally look at the juniors, the optionality, and the expiration plays, they do not believe that this move in gold is part of a sustainable trend. I think we need to see a sustained trend and an underlying logic as to why this trend will continue to carry on before we see the audiences feel comfortable to buy these optionality juniors and bet on exploration companies.
So, John, what about, too, that whole aspect of maybe an exploration company going out there and finding something major in a different jurisdiction? What has been running recently? We look at stuff like Great Bear Resources. That's in Canada, a well-known area in Ontario. We look at even now a little bit of a bidding war going on in Quebec over Alexandria Minerals. However, that stock, which I chatted about earlier in the week, that was kind of run into the ground by that management team. But at least there is a bidding war, and there are still stocks in Mexico that are getting a bid. How could maybe a bigger discovery in a new area also help this sector?
Well, traditionally, a big discovery that's like world class, in other words, is worth $1 billion plus, has excited the market and brought in lots of audiences. But I'm beginning to wonder if a single discovery by a junior can actually do that. And we had our example in early 2016 with Arizona Mining. It was 35 cents. It had come up with this deposit that was open pitable that really didn't work and was never going to get permitted. And then they drilled deeper and got really high grade zinc, lead, silver deposit. And 2 years later, they're bought out at $6.20 and a $2.1 billion cash buyout by South 32. And that really did nothing to inspire any other activity in Arizona where the project was located or in general. What we need, earlier in this year, I was pretty excited about the James Bay. This is in central Quebec. It's an area where there's been a fair amount of work in the past 20 years with the Eleanor discovery. And here was the potential for a new copper system of the sort not known for this region, and if it turned out to be world class, it was something nobody had ever really looked for. And all of a sudden, these juniors, which accidentally owned claims for completely different reasons, they would be potentially in the money. So we need a big discovery that changes the thinking for an area. And we're suddenly companies that people are stuck in for reasons that haven't, worked out, well, are suddenly back in the game and there's excitement and you don't know who's going to be the winner coming out of that. That's called a discovery-based area play. But for things like Great Bear, that has possibility for reviving that whole Red Lake district because, everybody assumes, okay, Goldcorp found this new high-grade gold aspect to a supposedly depleted system that they owned all the ground, and there's a little bit more found around it. But if you hopped a little farther, such as the Dixie, well, there was gold mineralization there, but it was of a different kind and it didn't really work out. And now everybody's thinking, is this going to be something new? Have they found similar to Red Lake and it's going to grow big? But the market needs to see like a Great Bear, not just go to $4 and then, find 1 million ounces and get absorbed by Newmont Goldcorp to add to their facility, but to suddenly go to $20, $30 because it suddenly has 5 to 10 million ounces of high grade. And that does not happen overnight. That's the problem with these discovery plays. They do have a 6 to 12 month validation cycle from the initial holds that suggest there is a discovery, and I really don't see much out there right now where I can say, this is going to lead to a revival of exploration interest in juniors.
Yeah, in all fairness too, John, we've seen some of the recent discoveries even be faded by the markets. You bring up a good point. The discoveries do take a long time to prove out and even prove initially outside of just one or two holes. But it's something we have seen where one or two holes can move the stock. And then as more holes are released that might not be as good or might be as good as those first few holes, the stock has been generally getting faded. There are some limited examples of stocks that kept running, but overall that money just is not flying in. One part of the sector that is doing really well is the royalty and streaming companies, though. Do you think these guys almost are being used as an ETF, and some of the larger money and also some of the speculators who are done playing single stocks are just focusing on this area?
Well, the royalty and streaming companies became popular because you had all these projects heading into production, and the gold price went down, but the costs didn't. And so you had questions about, how profitable are the producers themselves going to be? But a royalty is right off the top. The costs don't matter. And as long as they want to keep this operation going, the royalty company will benefit. And of course, if gold does start going up, there will be a leveraged impact on the producer, whom the market will be pricing pretty negatively based on actual cash flow, the difference between the gold price and the all-in sustaining cost per ounce. But the immediate go-to would be the streaming royalty company. And of course, the GLD ETF, insofar as you want to have a play just on the direction of the gold price. So the depressing thing with the example of like Midas Gold is the market has lost interest in betting on the actual companies as a proxy for gold, and that really needs to change. I don't think the streaming companies really are a threat. They're, more for the institutional audience, which right now is completely absent because they need a clear trend in place to go pile into the resource sector, period. And retail, they've been distracted by momentum trades such as cannabis, where you don't have to worry about cost because everything costs a ton of money. Nothing makes any money, but it's all about the winner take all sort of .com type revival. 20 years later, now we have it in the cannabis space, with the entire world eventually going to legalize and become a market for all these wannabe cannabis and cannabis derivative product future producers.
Well, that's one of the big distractions that continues to be. And you know what? It is more attracting some of those younger investors because it's a different market. It is a growing sector in terms of potential legalization. Plus, stocks have already given a lot of gains to some investors. John, you recently wrote up a stock, though, that I was surprised when you wrote it up, but it's a stock that I hold. That's Rugby Mining. They just kind of lost the permit, or they didn't get a permit in Colombia and have shifted focus to a property in the Philippines, which, from my understanding, they will be drilling soon. Why write up Rugby now?
Well, the Kaiser Research Online, with its spec value rating system, has a category called bottom fish. And bottom fish are companies where there's a management team or at least a project that's interesting. The company's not bankrupt, a zombie company with negative working capital and going to be rolled back or anything. And I look for these companies and I spotlight them as bottom fish. And I've had Rugby as a bottom fish off and on in the past 7-8 years. Exeter was a former recommendation that did extremely well. It went as high as $9 in 2010 with the Caspiche, and their spin out Extori Gold with the El Moro gold silver discovery in Argentina, it went to almost $15 in 2011, and they both got bought out subsequently at lower valuations. But these were exploration successes delivered by that team: Bryce Roxburgh, Paul Joyce, and Yale Simpson. And so these guys are serial discovery makers. And Rugby was this sort of when these other things are gone, this will be our plan C, where we get something going. And I'd kind of given up on the company. They've raised $20 million in the last 8 years, and they have maybe 1.2 million left, and they didn't really accomplish anything. So you kind of think, if these guys lost their touch. But part of the problem was in late 2010, when they started to focus on this, they secured two project deals, one in the Philippines, which they call the Motherlode, and the other in Colombia called Cobrasco. And both of them suddenly turned into endless frustration, because in the case of the Motherlode, some sort of license had expired that needed to be renewed, and they couldn't drill on the property itself. And they finally got their license in January this year. This is like 7 years later, but they couldn't do anything with this project. And Cobrasco in Colombia, they did all the right stuff. And then in April, they got the bad news that the forestry department in Colombia was not going to allow any work in this so-called Choco Copper Porphyry Belt. And so 7 years of waiting for nothing. But with the Motherlode project, it's an old vein that was mined out in 37 to 1953 for the mill burnt down. It probably goes deeper. They believe, or they even have evidence, that it sits on top of a copper gold porphyry system, and that these are sort of high sulfidation epithermal veins radiating from it. And on this island of Mindanao of the Philippines, they have these smallish max 200 million ton copper porphyry deposits that are enriched in copper and gold. And it's not a good place to try and open pit stuff. So you need the higher grade to do some underground block caving type of activity. Well, this company I wrote up because Yale Simpson picked up the phone and said, you know, John, I need to update you on Rugby. We finally have this project that we've been waiting for forever, ready to drill. And so I researched it. We went through it and looked at the story. And it's a simple two-hole program. The first hole will twin an old hole that an Australian company did way back in 2005. And it'll give them the core to properly log it and understand what's going on at depth. And they'll test both the deeper part of the vein system to see what's left there, and go right into the porphyry target at the base, where they have something the Australians didn't have, which was an IP survey. And what it showed was two chargeability highs, the one that sits right underneath the vein, and then a little bit offset to the south, another one, which has them thinking, oh, there's a fault here that has moved this whole system. There could be another 600-700 meters of high-grade vein off to the south. So they'll drill the second hole into this. And, you know, I wrote this up and nothing happened. So these guys, who are a proven discovery exploration team, rolling up their sleeves, picking up the phone, telling people we are going to start doing this, you know that first hole is going to have something good in it. They've spent the last 4 or 5 years on looking at other projects around the world. Who knows what they have their eyes on that they could put into this company. And it just sits there. And that's the problem. And this is why, if you believe that gold is going to get a sustained uptrend over the next 12 months and bring back the audiences, you have these incredibly cheap little companies. Yes, 100 million shares outstanding, but it's at 15 cents. That's a $15, $20 million valuation for a project that could end up being worth substantially more. You can go in there and buy this stuff quite readily in the market. So at the one hand, I'm totally depressed that everything just sits here. But the other hand, I tell myself, you have to keep slugging away. There are many little companies like Rugby Mining that are really cheap, good teams on board, stories that are interesting. And in this case, they picked up a portfolio from Barrick in Colombia with a bunch of pending applications. Barrick blew $20 million in Colombia before giving up on the country as useless in terms of getting permits for anything. So these guys, if they on this other batch of stuff start getting permits, they could be finally working in Colombia also, where there's an enormous amount of potential that, because of the difficulties in that country, have never really been tapped. So I'm pretty bullish about the opportunities out there. But I'm sort of wondering, when is this gold trend going to happen that really brings the audiences back?
Yeah, some more of this guarded bullishness. You're not alone there, John, because of the fact I think that the market has been just so tough. But now that we finally got a break in gold, it's just waiting to find finally something to happen for these juniors that I know a lot of us and our listeners are invested in, because there are still some good stories out there that just haven't moved and have continued actually to drift lower. John, great chatting with you. Thanks for taking some time on this weekend and sharing a new company that you wrote up, plus also your thoughts on what it might take to bring people, a broad base of investors, back into the sector. John, have a great rest of your weekend, buddy.
You too, Corey.
Oh, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm very excited to have Matt Geiger back on the show. He is the managing partner of MJG Capital Fund, which is a fund focused on the resource sector. I have had Matt on the show once before, and he is quickly turning into one of my favorite go-tos for resource comments. He is a bit younger, I believe around my age, so it is refreshing to see someone younger in the crowd. Plus, he's been making very nice returns with his resource fund, which even during those slow years, it takes skill to do something like that. Matt, I want to start off with more broad comments when we talk about trade wars. You and I haven't talked about trade wars on this show before, so I wanted to get your thoughts on how a potential trade deal, now we're not saying when that deal would come, but a potential trade deal with China and how it would relate to the U.S. dollar. Or would you see the dollar moving in a bullish sense or more in a bearish move?
It's a great question, Corey. And first, it's great to be back on the program. I want to wish a happy 4th of July weekend to your U.S. listeners, at the very least. So potential trade deal and the effect on the USD. My hypothesis at the moment, this is subject to change, but is that a trade deal between the U.S. and China would cause weakness in the U.S. dollar, so it'd be bearish the USD. I say this for a couple reasons. The first is that I would argue that so far, the dollar has been a beneficiary of trade war tensions because investors around the world have flocked to the USD as a quote-unquote safe haven amid these choppy waters and uncertain waters. Meanwhile, a deal would almost certainly be viewed as a quote-unquote risk-on event that would sap the safe haven appeal that the US dollar has enjoyed over the past 18 months. So I think a trade deal would be viewed as risk-on, and there'd be less of an incentive to hold U.S. dollars or the more conservative U.S. Stock markets, you know, relative to emerging markets per se.
Hey, that completely makes sense considering, you know, you look at what the dollar has done in the face of this trade war, and it has been bullish for the U.S. dollar. If we then take this into the metals, though, let's start off with the precious metals. If it is, let's say, bearish the U.S. dollar, you would think that would help the precious metals. However, if there is this more risk-on attitude, then that wouldn't help the U.S. dollar. So where does this tug of war end?
Fair enough. So I think, I guess I would say in terms of the likelihood of a trade deal in these coming months, my sense is that we will see some sort of resolution before the next U.S. presidential election. But in the meantime, I think we'll be in this twilight zone where the deal seems close and then farther off, and we kind of go back and forth between, you know, press reports from the U.S. and China. So I don't see anything in the imminent future. The reason for that is that President Trump, I think, politically likes the trade war. It shows that he's being tough on China and standing up for lost manufacturing jobs, for the United States working class. So as long as the U.S. markets are hitting 52-week highs and the Fed is, you know, showing some willingness to consider cutting rates, then I think Trump has no incentive to cut an immediate deal. So kind of with this framework in mind, I think gold, silver, you know, and the other precious metals, the PGMs, can continue to run in this type of environment. I'm not expecting a violent spike, but I think the technical level that we've broken within the past month is a very big deal. And so I think the precious names can continue to move. Base metals, I expect, should remain largely range bound. I think the effects of the trade war have been largely built into the prices of, you know, copper, zinc, and tin, iron ore, what have you. I do think the price dynamics for each of these base metals will depend also on individual supply-demand characteristics. And so in this environment, kind of switching to some of the junior names, I think the high-quality juniors focused on either precious metals or base metals should be able to create value in this type of market environment. The big risk, of course, is an acute global recession, you know, and or a 2008-like liquidity crisis, which could be painful for junior investors of all stripes. Even in the precious metals, a liquidity crisis would be very painful in the short term.
Yeah, that's one thing to always keep in mind, is that as much as you want to be optimistic on resource stocks during a recession or downturn, fact of the matter is they get sold off with pretty much everything else. Just one more comment regarding this trade deal is that even if we get a trade deal, there's been a lot of comments that maybe the trade deal is more or less weak in the sense that it doesn't get everything solved and a deal just gets done for more political reasons. Plus the fact of the world is in this slow growth at best type of environment, and a trade deal to me doesn't seem like it's going to change anything. So maybe that ties into some of the base metal comments where it comes down more to what actually goes on in the economy. What do you think about that concept, though, that a trade deal, albeit could be viewed positively initially, when people dive in, they'd see that, you know what, even with this trade deal, we're still stuck in this slow growth environment?
I think it's a fair point. I mean, I think the trade deal will be more psychological than anything. I don't know if I expect any major structural reforms, no matter how hard Trump and his team of advisors push. I think it would more be the point of coming to a resolution would be as a political victory than both the U.S. and China would declare victory. So in terms of, you know, the trade deal, I do think psychologically for the markets in the immediate aftermath, it would be a strong risk on event, as I've mentioned. I do think after a few months of reflection, people will start to dwell on the slowing growth, both in the U.S. and beyond. But I will say that central banks globally have shown that they care solely about growth and also maintaining the stock market's meteoric rise that we've seen over the past 10 years. You know, stoking inflationary pressures doesn't seem to be a worry. You know, a lot of people, including those of our age, you know, weren't even around for the 1970s. So the thought of an inflationary panic is so far off the radar that I think the central banks will err towards stimulating growth at all costs. So, you know, that could still be bullish in at least the medium term for most asset classes as they continue to try to stoke the flames.
Okay, let's move a little bit more into the junior mining sector, which you really do specialize in. We have had that nice breakout in gold above that 1370 area, which was multi-year resistance. So gold touching levels that we haven't seen in about 6 years. But with the stocks, you look at GDX, GDXJ, they also did break out, but not in the same degree. They're touching levels that we haven't seen since 2016. So still multi-year levels and highs for these. What do you think, though? Is this junior mining cycle, I guess, just getting going, this potential new bull market?
So I am now of the view that we have been in a stealth bull market, actually, since the depths of tax loss selling in late December 2018. So I think we discussed this during the last interview, but my view is that we were in a bull market, a junior mining bull market between January of 2016 all the way till January of 2018. Then last year was a dumpster fire, I would describe it as, for investors in this space. And so I think it's pretty indisputable that we were in a bear market through the whole of 2018. That said, you know, starting in the depths of tax loss season, it did look like a bottom had potentially been put in. And I've been thinking this for some time, that this was a distinct possibility, but it really was too early and uncertain for me to make a definitive call. However, for a few reasons, and you've mentioned a couple of them here, I'm now of the belief that we are indeed in a stealth bull market that's been going on for roughly 6 months. And I believe this for a handful of reasons. So the first is the strength in gold that you mentioned. And gold can often serve as a bellwether for the rest of the mining space. As most of your listeners are probably aware, gold broke through that key 1370 technical level. That gold failed and or failed to break on multiple occasions, I think 4 to 5 different occasions in the previous 5 years. So this is a pretty significant development. In the weeks since, gold has risen as high as 1440, and seems to have settled comfortably into this new trading range. So confirming this breakout on June 21st, we also saw the largest gold-focused ETF, the GLD, see record inflows, which is the most on a single day in the ETF's 15-year history. This and you know, as you mentioned, the GDX, GDXJ, Sprott Gold Miners ETF, while they aren't, you know, rocketing to, you know, multi-year highs, they also have hit 52-week highs within the past, you know, 5 or 6 trading days. So I think that's also confirmation of this. And then, you know, my view is that this outperformance will trickle down to the gold explorers and the gold developers in these coming weeks and months. So I'm not too worried about the lack of action we've seen amongst the junior names. I think that if these trends continue, that's just a matter of time. I will say, secondly, I believe we're in a stealth bull market because the major diversified names are also hitting 52-week highs. So this isn't just a gold story. If you look at the share prices of BHP, Rio Tinto, Fortescue, you know, these major mining companies that have their hands in dozens of different commodities, they've all hit 52-week highs just in the past few trading days. So this is indicative, to me at least, that there's more to be excited about than simply the precious metal equities. You know, as we've discussed, it may take a U.S.-China trade deal. In fact, it will likely take a U.S.-China trade deal for the base metals juniors to really, really start outperforming. But I think in the meantime, the high-quality, well-managed names should be able to get traction and create value. And finally, quickly here, the third reason I'm confident we're in this stealth bull market is anecdotally through the performance of the MJG fund. I won't be announcing our 6-month results at this point. I want to wait till our investor letter goes out later in July. But I can say that it was our third best 6-month period since the fund's inception. And it's the best 6 months of performance we've had since the second half of 2016. And even though there's been extreme pessimism pervading the junior space over previous months, I've heard multiple people say this is the worst mining market they've ever seen. To me, the fund's outperformance is evidence that the top stories are receiving actually a fair amount of investor attention, though I will say that the vast majority of juniors are struggling. This is why I describe this as a stealth bull market, as I said, and rather than, you know, a raging bull market where a rising tide lifts all boats. So those are kind of the three reasons why I now feel that we've been in a stealth bull market for the past 6 months in the junior space.
Those are completely fair reasons. And you know what? From a, well, historic standpoint, that is a lot of these factors that you point out are what we have seen as the bull market gets going. The large guys, the large miners move first, the diversified names, and then some of the high quality juniors also start to move. And then finally, we get to that time when even the not so good companies are also moving higher just because people want to invest in the sector. And boy, companies are real cheap market cap wise. Let's talk about some of the companies that you are excited about. What can you share with us, please?
Sure. So I'll talk about a few drilling plays. Two of these are holdings of the MJG fund. I want to emphasize these aren't recommendations for your listeners. We all have different risk preferences and different portfolio diversification that works for us. However, these are names that are currently undergoing drill programs right now that I'm excited about. So the first is a company called Adriatic Metals, who are working on their Rupice discovery in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So it is a bit of a spicy geopolitical jurisdiction, you could say. But the discovery they have here is absolutely world-class. And even for those that are unwilling to invest in a place like Bosnia, it's still one to watch closely. This was actually our featured investment in the fund's January 2019 investor letter. And I view it as really the best, the top mineral discovery globally in 2018. The company is just hitting obscene grades of 64 meters in one case of 26 grams per ton gold equivalent. I will say there's five different metals contributing to that gold equivalent grade. So the fact, you know, you need to factor recoveries in and be a little bit more conservative than that. But these are just obscene grades that if located in Canada or the United States or Australia, you know, this company would have a market cap that's 3 to 4x higher than its current state. Company based on these grades, I think a resource of only 8 to 10 million tons, which in the mining world is small, but I think even a small resource based off of these grades will see an NPV likely north of $1 billion and potentially higher. And the company is currently undergoing a 20,000-meter drill program, which will continue throughout the rest of this year. The company is well-capitalized and has the sufficient funds to do this. Any day now, we should get the drill results from some crucial step-out holes that are being drilled to the north of the Rupice discovery in what's called the Rupice Northern Extension. And these have the potential, depending on what is hit, to really move the share price. Just in the past week, we've also seen recent open market buying by Aussie base metal producer Sandfire, which I think validates the world-class potential of this project. I don't think we'd see a billion-dollar-plus company wading into it if they didn't think that there was major upside. Sandfire now owns 11% of Adriatic, and they look poised to make a run at the company and try to take over Adriatic as soon as its acquisition of Mod Resources is complete. So Adriatic's an exciting one to watch. The second one is Chicana Copper, which is the most recent open market position that we've added to the MJG portfolio. This company is also drilling 20,000 meters this year, which in the junior world, as you know, is a very hefty total. The wait for permitting has been a problem for this company. They're based in Peru, and as many South American investors would attest, the Peru permit situation has been in flux over the past couple years. And so the permitting waits are the reason why the company's share price has been in the doghouse. However, the rocks aren't going anywhere, and the company has a healthy working capital position to drill some high-impact targets this year that haven't been drill-tested before. And some of these examples include the Pipe 3 West, Pipe 7, Huancarama, and then the Paloma and Paloma East and Paloma West pipes. So there's a lot of untested land to be drilled this year. Additionally, similar to Adriatic, where Sandfire is validating the world-class potential of the deposit, here you have the major gold producer, Gold Fields, putting in $8 million into Chicana just within the past 60 days. This also happened at a pretty substantial premium to the company's current share price. So I think this one, too, even though there has been some chatter amongst the geological community that maybe there's not enough meat on this bone, maybe this isn't big enough, I think Goldfield's conviction in the project and their recent investment kind of puts those worries to rest. And then the final name I'll touch on briefly here is a name called Radius Gold, which is a post-discovery drill play that I've been watching closely. It's not a current holding of ours, but it's definitely an interesting story right now. They're working on the Amalia project down in Mexico. It's a joint venture with Pan American Silver, who's funding exploration expenditures in order to gain up to a 75% stake in the project. I will say there was some funny business with insider buying and selling, within the days before and after the discovery hole, which is a big red flag for me. But geologically, some geos and technical folk that I trust think that Amalia really has major potential here. And similar to Adriatic Rupices, due to the grades, you don't have to have that large of a deposit in order to see NPVs north of, you know, 500 million US or so. So this is one to watch. There's potential value creation there. I would maybe take a look at buying it below 20 cents. And there should be drill results out imminently for that story as well. So a couple ones for your listeners to put on their radar, and they can always reach out to me directly if they have questions about any of these names.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Matt. And if anybody wants to get in touch with Matt, please just email me, fleck@kereport.com. I'm happy to put you in touch. One thing that I think we can all take away from those companies that you like, some similarities there, one being cashed up and have large drill programs. They also have larger companies buying the share. And it's all about high grade, right? High grade findings and the potential to expand on that high grade. Yeah, there's no secret to what goes on for exploration companies and what drives them, but it's tough to drill right now, and it's tough to find high grade. And hey, some of those companies, in all fairness, one that I have not been following, I will look into a little bit more. I appreciate all those insights. Matt, it's great having you on the show. I love reading over your stuff, and I love that you take some time and share your thoughts with our audience. Have a great rest of your weekend. That goes for everybody. And Matt, I'll be having you back on the show again sometime soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Corey. Take care.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.